Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Here, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Here newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
The Guardian.
It's an enormous pleasure for me to introduce to you the 162nd series of Royal Institution Christmas Lectures.
Starting in 1825, the Royal Institution Christmas Lectures have seen the likes of Michael Faraday, David Attenborough and Monica Grady take centre stage.
What I believe, and many other people believe, to have been the greatest experimental scientist who ever lived, Michael Faraday.
Continuing this string of science's brightest stars, this year's lectures will be given by Professor Sophie Scott, a cognitive neuroscientist from University College London. With a career spanning over two decades, much of Sophie's work has looked at what's happening in the brain when it comes to vocal communication in humans. But what was it that first attracted Sophie to neuroscience? What has her groundbreaking work into communication, including laughter, revealed? And looking towards our digital future, how is the communication landscape changing?
Some of these things we tend to study in silos. So for a very long time, I studied speech perception, and then I started looking at speech production, and then I started saying, oh, how does speech perception and speech production to relate to one another? But of course, in the wild, you never do either on your own. It is interesting because we attribute it to people. We think we laugh because of clever things people say, but actually we're mostly laughing because we like those people.
I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
My, is this working?
Yeah, no, I didn't have it switched on.
Oh, that's helpful.
Very clever.
Sitting down in the studio with Sophie, I started by asking her where it all began.
Sophie, you're a leading neuroscientist, but what was it about the brain that first drew you into studying it?
Serendipity, really. I was happened to be doing a postdoc in Cambridge around the time that people started to get their hands on these new brain imaging techniques that let you take the photographs of normal brains in actions. I say photographs, but you know, literally images of activity, like positron emission tomography and fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging. They were getting off the ground, and it was a slightly... A lot of it was in the control of medics, but it was starting to spread out from that. And I got involved in studies because people needed some technical help. And I found it very, very interesting. I'd done a biology degree originally, and it was interesting to me to be able to relate behaviour and perception and sort of experience to a brain framework in by thinking about how normal brains work. But most of what we'd learnt up to that point we knew from, you know, I was working a lot with patients and trying to work out, you know, what had gone wrong. So it was quite exciting to be able to sort of look at just a normally functioning brain and take, you know, snapshots of it in action.
And what sort of questions were you looking at then? Sort of what was it that was sort of causing you sort of always curiosity?
I wanted to know how brains process sound and particularly speech, because I had a sort of speechy background and I was interested in that side of it. And it's a big clinical problem because people can have, you know, an aphasic stroke that leaves them unable to understand what someone's saying. And we didn't really know what the you know, quote, normal pattern of activity would be. And that was turned out to be quite a technically challenging thing to investigate. So it was a good time to be in it because it was all very new. And it was a time when you could sort of really find things out. You know, you're not, obviously not like it's such, we've done all the science and now no one needs to do anything else, but you could sort of, you know, there were discoveries to be made. Now, Was it, one of my friends said it's a lot of the low-hanging fruit got picked off in that decade in the 90s. And of course, you still go back and revise it and you understand more about the complexity and how these systems are working in finer grain detail. But for sort of mapping out big networks, that was kind of where I got involved. So what's the speech perception network? And then that led to looking at speech production as well, and then looking at other aspects of the information in our voices. And it just got more enriched as a program, I guess.
One of the things you mentioned just now is about how it was the speech and how you'd always been a sort of speechy person. It just talk me through that. What is it about speech and communication that has sort of captured you?
I suppose I'm being slightly disingenuous because when I was an undergraduate, I wanted to study music psychology and I started a PhD thinking I was doing a PhD on music psychology. And I still don't absolutely understand what's gone wrong. How did that not happen? But I ended up looking at a lot of speech in my PhD. And then that kind of, I just studied phonetics and I studied signal processing. And I just, speech is very, very interesting as a sound and as a behaviour and as a communicative tool. So it is, and I mean, as music is, it is very, very interesting. And I think I was always, as a child, I was very interested in how people talked and different sorts of accents. And I lived in a household in, you know, I grew up in Blackburn in Lancashire, and I had a strongly Lancastrian accent at school when I came home. And I would be told not to speak that way by my parents, who were from the south of England, and were mildly horrified if you talked about having a bath. So I was kind of aware of that. And I don't think that's unusual in the UK, but it is certainly... I'm not a greatly skilled linguist, but I'd always been interested in how and why people talk. And that's essentially a lot of what I've ended up looking at, really, is why we sound the way we do.
So talk me through some of the big questions in your research now. So what is it that you're looking at and focusing on and trying to pick apart?
I'm really interested in how some of these things we tend to study in silos. So for a very long time, I studied speech perception, and then I started looking at speech production. And then I started saying, oh, how does speech perception and speech production to relate to one another? But of course, in the wild, you never do either on your own. You know, they are largely things that you do when you're around other people. So it's a social behaviour. And I'm interested in understanding how these kind of networks that we've generally studied in isolation actually get deployed when you see people using them in the wild. So, you know, conversational speech is a completely universal use of the human voice. And I'd really like to know the intricacies of how you're, you know, using speech perception, speech production in a situation where you have to align it with somebody else. And you do align so much of your behaviour when you talk to somebody else. It's like a dance of the voices. So I really want to understand that kind of dynamic.
As alluded to by Sophie, the way she and many others see language is not just as a way to exchange knowledge, but also as a social tool. And it's both these aspects of language that make it so crucial in our own evolutionary history.
One of the other things that obviously has...
But, as explained by Sophie, trying to place any kind of detail into this history is incredibly difficult when it comes to speech and communication.
It is difficult because a lot of the stuff that we use for speaking or we use to understand speech doesn't fossilise. So brains don't fossilise, the tongue doesn't fossilise, lips, a lot of the stuff, the, you know, the soft tissue, we're left with no real idea of what was going on. What we're left with is skeletons, and we can work out from looking at skeletons aspects of, for example, when we got the breath control to be able to speak. And that came in late. Homo ergaster, the Narikotomi boy, it was, you know, those were good candidates for predecessors of modern humans, and they were living in complicated societies and looking after each other and hunting and making tools, and they were graceful runners. But they weren't talking to each other. They didn't have this, what's called a thoracic expansion, which you can see in the spine and which it lets you control breathing for speech. Now, at some point between then and now, humans got that. Well, you know, when modern humans appeared, although Neanderthals have it as well. So there's Neanderthals seem to have had some of the same breath control. And one of the things that intrigues me about this is that we can look at some other things about our skeletons and say, what did we need to have before we could talk? So if you look at the shape of our skulls, we have very flat muzzles on our mouths. We don't have long, snouty faces. And the roof of our mouth is domed. So we have quite a neat little space for making the sounds of speech. And we're kind of powering that with our breathing and then shaping the sounds. But of course, we had to have all that in place before we could talk. So whatever it is that we're seeing from the evolutionary perspective, from the fossils, tells us when we had the sort of structural things you'd need to be able to speak. But it doesn't necessarily tell you why we got them, because you couldn't talk until you had them. So it's possible there may be other things that fed into that. So one of the things we know you can do with breath control and a descended larynx, which is harder to work out from fossils. But you can sing and you can do musical things with your voice. And maybe that kind of something more unrelated to linguistic factors and more to do with sort of performance and enjoyment of the voice musically might be something that had driven that. I mean, you know, I'm not the first person to suggest this. It's also possibly the case that language itself was simply an invention of this body that we have and a ways of making sound that we have. If you look at writing, there's good evidence that human writing systems have been invented several times throughout human history. And we didn't evolve to write, but writing's a great use of our right-handedness and our careful precision grip and fine movements we can make with our fingers. And maybe the same is true of spoken language. Maybe spoken language has evolved or been discovered many times just as an, you know, an inventive use of our voices.
Communication and ideas that people have about how we communicate and how we talk are often sort of riddled with myths as well. Do you find yourself having to debunk sort of ideas, you know, women talk more than men or that kind of thing?
Yes. I mean, you can try. Certainly try.
Thankless task, is it?
I think because the brain is an appealing metaphor for our kind of aspirations and hopes and what we'd like to be, it's so comforting to say, well, this is just the way it is because those brains are different and that's what can you do? You've got a different brain. The sort of issues around male and female brains is a perennial version of that, and particularly around language because there are strong beliefs that people have. There was a really persistent belief that women had language lateralized, not strongly lateralized to the left as men do, but sort of across both hemispheres, and it's still not really gone away, and there really is not well supported. So for example, both men and women are likely to have an aphasic stroke if they have damage to the left hemisphere, because that's where language is in most people. Mm. And in fact, other ways of looking at kind of just where is language in the brain don't tend to show you anybody with language spread across both hemispheres. It's either in the left or for some people it's in the right. But that just keeps bubbling along. The example you give of women talking more than men is another good one, in that there's good behavioural evidence now that there is a difference between men and women if you look at meta-analyses across, you know, many papers on the top subject. And there's a difference between men and women, and the difference is men talk more than women. And it's modulated by context. So the situation where men talk most more compared to women is when one man's talking to one woman. 1,000-yard stare there. But the effect size is tiny. Yeah. It is meaninglessly small. So it's tiny, it's robust, you can exaggerate in certain circumstances, and no one believes it. If they tell one to believe it, they go, oh, that doesn't sound right to me. Chatty women. And off you go again. So, you know, you can try and bust myths sometimes all you wish without necessarily having much joy, but all you can do is keep talking about it. So one of the things I find quite interesting, given that I, you know, spent a long time working in speech and language and this in the brain, almost the least important part of your brain's response to the kinds of stuff I look at is whether you're a man or a woman. You know, I just, it's so uninteresting to me. We don't even bother doing specific analysis on it because things like your age and your experience, those will affect individual differences much more than, you know, boring gross stuff like if you're a man or a woman.
But it's not just speech that Sophie has focused on during her career. And after this short break, we'll hear about another area of her research.
As soon as I started doing that, laughter just runs away from you because it's everywhere. It's absolutely everywhere. It's universally recognised. It's an incredibly robustly recognised sound. And there's just no research into it.
We'll also hear how the landscape of human communication is changing.
Emojis are interesting because they are really sharply polarising people's opinions at the moment, but in fact they're just another example of stuff we always try and do with written language.
We'll be right back. Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of another podcast here at The Guardian. It's called Brexit Means, and as the name would suggest, it attempts to finally find out what exactly Brexit does mean, apart from, of course, Brexit. So if you feel like delving into the nitty-gritty of Britain's exit from the EU, be sure to join John Henley and his experts on The Guardian's Brexit Means. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Brexit Means on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Nicola Davis. Before the break, we heard from cognitive neuroscientist Professor Sophie Scott about her journey into the world of communication and language. We heard about the possible origins of language. Could it be that our bodies invented speech? And for those of you who might have forgotten, we also heard that it's men, not women, who tend to talk ever so slightly more.
It's laughter, and in fact you're no stranger to stand-up comedy yourself.
But speech is only a small part of Sophie's research.
I got into laughter around the same time I got into functional imaging back in the 90s. I had colleagues in Cambridge who were doing a lot of work on how we recognise emotion from the face. And this was my dear friend Andy Calder. And he was working with patients who had specific problems recognising facial information following very particular kinds of brain damage. And they were finding some of these patients had real difficulties recognising particular expressions like of emotions like fear and anger. And I got involved because they could test across modalities, what is true in the face, what do we find with the voice. Mm. And I just got really interested from that. You know, there wasn't much research. You know, the emotion literature primarily means visual stuff, mm. certainly for recognition. And also all the emotions we were working with were negative. It was always fear and anger and disgust and sadness. And I got into laughter because I started talking to the people who were, you know, doing the more important basic work on emotions about why that was. And a guy called Paul Ekman, who'd done the really nice work in the 60s and 70s showing that you can find some facial expressions of emotion are recognised across all human cultures. He'd actually suggested that there would be more positive emotions out there, but you wouldn't really look at them well with faces. You should look at bodies and you should look at voices. And I thought, great, you know, I look at voices. And as soon as I started doing that, laughter just runs away from you because it's everywhere. It's absolutely everywhere. It's universally recognised. It's an incredibly robustly recognised sound. And there's just no research into it. There's literally a handful of papers academically. The majority of the papers there are, which are very few, are cases of pathological laughter in sort of neurological or neuropsychological reports. There's very little academic study of it, which made it quite interesting because, you know, stumbling on an area where you seem to find this very common behaviour that's not being researched mm. is intriguing. And then the more you look at it, just the more interesting and nuanced and complex it is as a behaviour. So it's been laughter's been good to me. It's very interesting.
And tell me a bit about what you found then. So is it that we have different kinds of laughter for different situations? Or just sort of give me an insight into...
It's really common and we don't laugh at what we think we laugh at. So there's a chap in, to be fair to him, a guy called Robert Provine in the US who's been studying a lonely path on laughter for a few decades. And he pointed out very early on that actually most laughter is not at jokes and humour, though we think it is. We think we laugh at jokes and comedy. Most laughter happens in social interactions and it happens when you're talking to other people. And you laugh in a very coordinated way when you laugh with other people. You laugh at the end of sentences. You laugh, you know, you really tightly integrate it into your conversation. And although you will laugh at jokes and humour, most of the time you're laughing at statements and comments. And you're laughing the person you're talking to as much to show, you know, you can laugh because you're amused, but you're also laughing to show that you know them, you're affiliated to them, you're part of the same group, you like them, you understand what they're saying, you agree with what they're saying, you can see the implications of what they're saying.
So it's not just that you think that they're a great wit, is that true?
I mean, if you didn't like them, you probably wouldn't laugh and you probably wouldn't think they were a great wit. But it is interesting because we attribute it to people. We think we laugh because of clever things people say, but actually we're mostly laughing because we like those people and we're enjoying their company, and you're marking it in this really complicated way. And then it becomes a very sort of useful social skill because you can also use it in very transient interactions where you can just make something go more smoothly. So someone chased me off, you know, I got off a bus the other day and somebody ran after me with my bag and I said thank you and sort of laughed to indicate I'm really sorry, that was a stupid thing of me and I know I've put you out a bit there, and they laughed like, oh no, it's okay. And, you know, just sort of smoothing over. A better example, I was stopped to help a little girl who'd fallen off a scooter in Regent's Park a few weeks ago, and I thought for a horrible second she was completely on her own and she was crying, and then I heard behind me laughter and her mum was sort of tearing up with the pushchair laughing, and her laughter was telling her daughter that it's okay, don't worry, I'm here, and it was telling me don't worry, I'm on the case and you can bugger off now, you know. But very nicely,
yeah,
you know, yeah. unknown woman who's sort of with my child, I'm going to move you on smoothly. And yeah. it gives interactions quite a sort of neutral in some ways, yeah, positive.
Like kind of benign, yeah, sort of flagged.
Yeah. So it's a very skilled behaviour. And we get good at it over quite a long time scale. We have limited data, but suggesting that you get, particularly the social use of laughter, certainly if you look at recognition, people being able to spot social laughter, your abilities don't peak at that till you're in your late 30s. You have to learn about it throughout, in real time, throughout your real life.
And just to go on with this a little bit, is how important is emotion in our communication? Because as you were saying earlier, you know, one gets quite hung up on the words that you're saying, like, oh, did I say that right? Have I put that across in the right way? How important are the words compared to how you're saying it or the other sides of communication?
Words are obviously critically important, and it's the bare, you know, if there aren't words there, then you are left with some other form of interaction. But it's always a social signal. A conversation, even a written conversation, is a social interaction of some kind, that there will be more than just the abstract information there. People are always trying to work out your intention and your meaning and where are you going with that. And so whether you want to or not, all interactions have got some kind of emotional and social impact. And it's a lot easier in some ways to deal with, particularly when you're an adult and you've done a lot of conversations. You can manage that in face-to-face interactions quite well because you've got a lot of tools at your disposal, like laughter, like tone of voice, like facial expression. It's harder when you go down to text-based interactions because you lose all of that. Mm. And I found myself agonising over how to write an email so I don't sound like I'm demanding something, but I also don't want to sound like I'm going,
like wishy-washy.
Oh, everybody, yeah. Yes, come along, let's have a laugh and get that whole project done, shall we? You know, so it is very difficult, and people have always struggled with that with text. I mean, everyone's probably had the experience of an email being misunderstood, or particularly if somebody wishes to misunderstand your email. But it's because you are on this very sort of denuded frame of just the words.
Earlier this year, it was announced that you'll be giving this year's Royal Institution Christmas Lectures, which is really exciting. How did it feel to be asked? Because I know that you always used to love them as a child. So just talk me through what it felt like to be given that baton to carry.
Oh, it was amazing. It was absolutely delightful. There are, you know, a handful of experiences in your life when you can point to things and go, that was just unmoderated joy. That was just delightful. So they'd asked me to come for a meeting. And they even contacted me on Twitter. It wasn't even like an email. So I went along thinking, oh, what's, you know, because that sort of contact is normally like, you know, disrespect, but would you come do our podcast? Yeah. You know, it's a kind of an informal sort of touch base. Do you want to help us out with that? So I wasn't expecting anything like it. And I was quite surprised when it was like a grown-up who I was meeting. I sort of thought I was meeting someone, you know, like this is a project they got running over the summer or something. And they asked me to do the Christmas section. I just had no idea. I had no idea. So it was just delightful. Like, if you want to take out a memory on a bad day and think about a happy thing, that's a happy thing to think about. Because I was just bouncing around the room for the rest of the day. I was floating.
So talk me through a bit about what you're going to discuss. I know you don't want to give away too many spoilers because we've all got to tune in and watch.
Absolutely,
but,
yes.
I heard tell that emojis are one of the things you want to look at. Just talk me through what that's all about.
So we're going to have a little bit of a look at emojis. And I think emojis are interesting because they are really sharply polarising people's opinions at the moment. But in fact, they're just another example of stuff we always try and do with written language to express ourselves more clearly. Particularly, I mean, no one's really thinking you're going to be putting them in your essays or writing a novel with them. In when we're using language for an interaction, which is when you're worried about how you write an email, that's where emojis are coming in. And we've always tried to find ways of using punctuation or, you know, look at handwritten letters and people underlining things to try and make our meaning clear. And at the dawn of the internet, you remember people used to start using those sort of ASCII emoticons and smiley faces, but also like shrugs and also, you know, and you can see or the evolution things like lols and ruffles and rufflecopters and that, all, you know, kind of just different, trying to put some voice, some speaker back in there. Yeah. And you have emojis now as another kind of format for that. And it has been very interesting watching them being used. Like, I did not know that I really wanted a way of expressing approval until I had those little hand claps or the approval sound, like, 100% thing. I love saying that. Yes. You know. So I didn't even know that was a thing I was missing. And now I can kind of exploit it in interactions in this text-based medium. So I think they're interesting as watching them being used and watching the kind of people exploiting it. But then that's absolutely always happened with communicative methods. As long as you go back throughout human history, from when people started making marks on walls to record information, that's been putting some aspect of our cognition and our communication out into the world in a format that's not just words that disappear. And so, I mean, spoken words that disappear. So it's an old tendency to take new technology and exploit it for communication. And you just see it shifting. So if you go back to my grandparents' generation, they would... My mum has a whole pile of postcards that my grandfather, who was working away, had sent back and forth with his wife. And you could get several back and forth. You could have whole conversations throughout the day because there were that many posts.
Wow.
And then, of course, the phone came along and just took that out.
Yeah.
And then when we got mobile phones, we all started using SMS texting, which no one saw coming. We stopped talking to each other largely and went back to text. So it's like a moving tide of we will push things out, often in a direction where nobody saw that coming. Mm. So it would be interesting to see what happens with emojis and how that sort of spreads out. The other one I'm interested in is how people use GIFs.
That's
exciting. Yeah, because I think people quite often, given you could have anything in that GIF, people still largely go for facial expressions.
Yes.
You're putting in a kind of nuanced, I really like, there's one of Eric Morecambe looking frustrated at the piano. And I like wildly overuse that because that's exactly getting at a sort of an emotional expression I wish to put into my written conversation, but it's very hard to say that in words.
Good afternoon. I'm very pleased to be here at the Royal Institution to give this set of Christmas lectures on the planets.
And finally, you're known as one of the best advocates for communicating science to the public. How important is it to look at new and exciting ways that science can be communicated?
I think it is very important. I think it's important across a number of different fronts. I think it helps individual scientists. It doesn't matter how good your science is. If you don't write papers that people read, if you don't give talks that people can live through and want to continue listening to, they are never going to give you the good grace of reading your papers or finding out more about your work or taking it seriously. So I think at an individual level, thinking seriously about how you communicate is a really important personal skill. And I think it's equally, if not more important, in terms of the sorts of messages we can start sending people about who scientists are and what scientists do. So I can remember being absolutely astounded watching the Christmas lectures when I was a child, when I kind of clicked that these guys, and they were all guys then, were outlining research that was ongoing. Mm. It wasn't like, here is a body of work, and we will tell you about the body of work, because that's the kind of feeling you got about science at school. Mm. Like,
it's all done and dusted.
Exactly, we'll talk about all the trees. It's a process, it's going on, and these people actually do it. People actually do this job. It's a process and it's done now. So that was kind of amazing to me. And then of course the next stage is, who are those people? And we know that if you ask school children, boys and girls, to draw scientists, they draw men. And they don't draw a random variety of men either. So, you know, just the more you can be doing to put out there what scientists, the variety of scientists, the variety of approaches, because there's not one way of being a scientist. There's definitely not one way of getting into science. There's all sorts of different routes people take. And then, of course, all sorts of things you can do with your science once you've got it. So you should be celebrating and paying more attention to scientists in all kinds of areas of public life, because it's not that, you know, a scientist who doesn't become somebody tinkering with, you know, test tubes is a failed scientist, you know. So I think it helps for transparency. It helps for perception scientists, and anything you can do to kind of capture somebody's imagination and think, yeah, I'd love to do that. I'd like to know more about that.
My topic is the planets. We, of course, live on one. It's called the Earth. And it is a tiny little planet.
So for me, watching Carl Sagan on the Christmas lectures, that was what really kind of sparked my interest. And of course, I not ended up doing astrophysics at all. Astrophysics was the gateway drug for me to end up looking at neuroscience. But that, so it's not even necessarily going to be a straightforward link from the science you're talking about. But when you're, you know, looking at the world of adults when you're growing up and thinking about things you could do and stories that you could be part of, the more variety and the more examples of that that you see, the more likelihood there is that you'll see something that captures your interest.
To show how the planets move. There were lots of them made a few centuries ago, not so many these days. The brass sphere in the middle is supposed to represent the sun. And if I turn this crank, you can see the planets moving.
Special thanks this week to Professor Sophie Scott.
The planets moving extremely slowly.
To find out more, make sure you tune in to her Christmas lectures, where she'll be discussing many of the topics covered in this podcast and more.
The moon next to it, then Mars, Jupiter with four of its 12 or so moons shown, and then over here, Saturn with its rings.
If you've got any questions, queries or feedback, please get in touch via our email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com.
To fit on this orrery are the planets Uranus, Neptune and Pluto.
I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
There's been a recent discovery of a tiny little planet out here between Saturn and Uranus. Perhaps it is a single small planet, or perhaps it is one of a great horde of little planets which might circle the sun.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.